Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonorable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, how personally painful has OnlyFans' decision to no longer allow pornographic content been for you?
Well, the fact that pleasure and pain exist on the same spectrum, I think, really needs to be taken into consideration here. Like, is it just really helping me to expand into the sensation of being a human? I don't know. I don't think this metaphor started good, I think. And then it did fall apart incredibly quickly. Funnily enough, no OnlyFans. I've only been like, it's kind of a meme of even kind of like hardcore. It's kind of a meme of like content creators being asked to create an OnlyFans.
Right.
Surprise, surprise. And
how many times have you been asked then?
Once, okay. Which I find really depressing.
I'd like
to be asked more. Yeah. And then I'd complain about being sexualized by my audience.
It's nice to be asked still.
You know, yeah. Exactly. And then I can have a little bit of a moan and maybe ban them from live chat.
Indeed. So this is the story that OnlyFans, which is is it a social media platform? I don't know. It's a sort of content creation platform.
Is it social if it's a closed network? Great question.
These are all great questions. But whatever it is, the owners have decided that they will no longer...
It's a crowdfunding platform. It's a subscription service platform. So it's kind of like in the same way we ask for money with Patreon where we get paid every thing that we put up. It is similarly a closed platform where you upload content for... wait for it, only your fans.
There you go.
And your fans are charged a monthly subscription to have access to that content.
So this website has become famous over the last year primarily for the pornographic content that some people
put out. I find it very interesting that it's only existed in your sphere for about a year.
I wasn't really aware of it before about a year ago. I mean, the website was founded in 2016.
And then when lockdown happened, you were like, well, there's only so much Pornhub I can watch, you know, let's spice this up.
I've still never been on OnlyFans website.
www.onlyfans.com.
Even to research this topic, which shows my commitment to doing the background reading. But they've decided, under pressure from various financial services that no longer want to process payments for them, that they will stop allowing pornographic content, which there is other stuff that people sort of do, like cooking instructional videos and, you know, other odds and sods on OnlyFans, but it's mostly known for its porn content.
It's the minority of content. Kind of like, actually, I mean, the similarities have been drawn with Tumblr, which also banned all pornographic content, and I believe there was an estimation that Tumblr was 60% pornography before it blocked all porn on the site for similar reasons, because it was looking to be acquired by a larger company. OnlyFans one is more linked to the processing of payments, so the likes of Visa and MasterCard won't process their payments unless they can guarantee specifically that there isn't any kind of like child abuse content on the site.
So,
or any underage content.
So we are going to be talking about that as our third and final topic. But the first two things we are going to be...
The first two.
Yeah, we're doing this in reverse order you'll see that I couldn't come up with...
OnlyFans was a funnier cold open.
Yes, yeah, well, basically. There's little whimsical question opportunities in the other two topics. So obviously the major news story from the past fortnight has been the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan. It's sort of hard in some ways to know where to begin with this topic because there's so much going on around it, and there's been, you know, so many reactions in the American and British political spheres as well. There's conversations going on about how many refugees various countries are going to be taking in. You know, questions about whether we should have pulled out, questions about what sort of military intelligence that the former allies were relying on that suggested that this wouldn't happen as quickly as it did in terms of the Taliban taking over. And I think we're just going to be talking about mostly about the reaction, because a couple of episodes ago we did discuss when when the withdrawal was sort of mooted properly and when it was outlined, and we discussed the many people were saying that the Taliban takeover would happen quickly, and I think now we're going to be delving much more into the reactions to it and what happens next, basically. Jazzy, do you want to introduce our third and final topic?
Yeah, what a fucking shit show. And our third and final topic is on the shooting that happened, is it a couple of weeks ago now? In Plymouth, yes. In southwest England. By Jake Davidson, who shot five people and then killed himself, I believe, ended up taking three of those five people with him.
Five people died. He shot an additional two people who survived, I think.
Right, okay, got it. He has been... It's the first kind of like mass shooting that the UK has seen in about a decade. There has been a lot spoken about the fact that he was active in kind of like incel circles, involuntary celibate circles, which all of a sudden everybody on mainstream media is now an expert on, which is quite cute. From my perspective, it's been quite strange to see something that is kind of like a reference in my space as kind of like a content creator on the internet, then become kind of like raised up as a terrorist ideology, and talked about as an ideology. And I think that there are some generalizations and limitations to describing it as such, but we are going to continue the conversation and talk about it. There's also been a number of things around like how easy it was for him to have a gun license, stuff like mental health, and this gunman's murderers, kind of like what motivated it, why did this happen, how did it happen, how did we stop it happening. Jimmy also wrote a really good piece on this in his Substack that encouraged empathy and feeling sorry for the murderer. Interesting.
You already said it was really good, so you know, you can't be hands off about it now. But we are going
to
be...
I can pretend to be a dick, that's fine.
We're going to be playing some music, and we're going to tell you a little bit about our Patreon account.
About our Patreon account and our newly launched OnlyFans. Oh, wait.
I don't know what sort of content you'd have in mind for that, but we can discuss that off the record. I think.
Feet do great. Also, I don't think would breach OnlyFans content policies, because it's only nudity and sexually explicit stuff that would be regulated. So that's how we make that money, Jimmy. Feet.
The feet market. I'll bear that in mind. Mm-hmm.
Hello, dear listener. Jazza here, and it's the part of the podcast where we remind you that we are listener-supported 100%. Without the people who choose to support us on the crowdfunding platform Patreon, which is kind of like OnlyFans but with fewer feet, we would be out of pocket making this podcast, and it really is with your support that we're able to keep this going into 191 episodes. We want to thank you really sincerely, Gemma, Matt, John, Michael, Andrew, David, Alexander, and a new one, Jer. Hello, babe. Thank you so much for choosing to throw some money our way. If you would like to support the podcast, you can do from as little as $1 per episode. Super cheap, if you ask me. Without further ado, let's go on with the show.
So, Jazza, I actually did something that I almost never do and listen back to our podcast from several episodes ago where we discussed Afghanistan.
I do that all the time, but then I do have an insatiable ego, and I'm not making YouTube videos at the moment, so...
That's what gives you your kicks. That's good to know.
100%. I should put it on my own OnlyFans.
Very much so, yeah.
Sorry, well, we'll stop. This is a serious topic at the moment. I apologise.
when we were discussing this, it was predicted that within 6 months, the Taliban would probably have control of Afghanistan. As it has now transpired, it's happened much quicker than that. I think, I don't know how you sort of track the timeline in terms of like...
It was something like 3 or 4 weeks.
3 or 4 weeks.
Was it not?
Yeah. That sounds about right. So that was between like most of the American troops leaving and the Taliban actually rolling into Kabul and taking control of like the presidency's office and taking control
of
the government.
Who's now fled to the UAE with a load of cash.
Yeah. So,
I mean, he's lucky he won an election. That's all I'm saying.
Well, I think we could potentially get into discussing the president and the kind of approach that you know, the various governing structures, such as they were, had to actually running Afghanistan. But what I suppose that the top line in all of this is that this takeover has happened a lot faster than people predicted, although it was widely predicted at the time that the Taliban would eventually gain control. I don't know if I've misunderstood Joe Biden's position on this, but he almost seemed, in the various press conferences he's been giving, surprised by what happened. And I don't think that what happened was necessarily surprising, other than the speed of how quickly it took place, right?
I'm curious what came across as surprised. I don't think he did come across as surprised by it. Other than, like you said, the speed. He seemed very, very keen to throw the Afghan forces under the bus very quickly. Yeah. And basically, like, well, they decided not to fight and just let the Taliban roll into the major cities. And eventually, obviously, that culminating in them walking into Kabul. I don't know. He seems pretty defiant. But it's understandable why he is... Right, because he has his. It was a promise that was made by him and by the previous administration. There was already the expectation that they were going to try and get people out before the September 11th deadline, which was the 20-year anniversary of the September 11th attacks, obviously. And I don't think that he or the American people really seem to care.
No,
to be honest,
no.
Like it is top level American hawk politicians that seem to have a problem with it, whereas support for leaving Afghanistan seems to be pretty high, and I don't think that there is an appetite for nation building, and I don't think there ever really was. We talk about the early 2000s as there being, maybe because of the successes of. Kind of like some interventions in the 90s. Maybe I'm mischaracterizing it, but I don't think the American people, and I would probably say the British people as well, don't have an appetite for staying in Afghanistan.
No, I think that's true.
And they don't really understand why we were in there. 20 years is a long time.
Well, in some ways it's not entirely clear what the objective was. I mean, in some ways, the Afghan invasion, also the invasion of Iraq, were pure reactions to September the 11th. And a lot of the thinking around them was around this idea of ungoverned spaces that were breeding grounds for terrorism and a desire to actually close those down and actually impose order in that way. It gradually, in the case of, I suppose this is true of Iraq as well, but it evolved, both of those missions evolved into sort of half-hearted nation-building exercises. And, I mean, I suppose by comparison, Iraq actually looks like a much more successful mission than Afghanistan does. But I think it's... The idea that was in some people's heads that you'd eventually be able to turn these countries into something resembling liberal democracies in the manner of, you know, the Japanese reconstruction or, you know, West Germany during the Cold War, or South Korea as well. That idea has not transpired in this instance. I think this is definitely true of the American public. They just don't have the appetite for these kind of foreign adventures. And I guess you could argue, I mean, you already have done, did they ever have that sort of appetite? Not for like short-term kind of operational things where you like attack a country and you know, you maybe remove a dictator, or you actually fight a military force in a like conventional way. But actually these long-term missions where you're effectively sort of running a temporary colony of sorts,
mm-hmm.
And trying to change the governance structure of those countries. I don't think it's entirely clear. I mean, I think it's not purely just like sort of neocons who dislike this and think it's a bad idea and that it will generate instability. There are some more cautious types, like I'm particularly thinking of the likes of Rory Stewart, who...
Mm-hmm.
You know, former government,
who was previously the a candidate for the prime ministership,
yes,
running against Boris Johnson,
yeah, and was also the former minister for international development, I want to say, among other mm-hmm. things,
which now doesn't exist anymore.
Yes, and his argument is that actually we could have maintained, we being the British and the Americans, could have maintained a small footprint of, say, a couple of thousand soldiers and, you know, some relevant military contractors as well who are involved in helping the Afghan army in terms of its equipment and that kind of thing. And we could have actually just maintained a long-term presence there for relatively little cost. I mean, many people have made the arguments that actually British and American forces have not suffered fatalities for, I think, more than a year in terms of actual... there have been some accidental deaths, but like in terms of somebody actually physically attacking and killing them, that hasn't happened for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And some people have argued that actually our presence there was sustainable and that the gains in terms of how the country was better run in terms of women's rights, which has been a major talking point throughout all the coverage of this, those things were slowly improving, and that actually it was a worthwhile investment to actually manage
There's
things.
There's been
those
a generation of very highly educated Afghan women who are not allowed to go to school generally under Taliban rule.
Yeah.
And though there has been a media charm offensive by the Taliban with press conferences, novel.
yeah, it's a bit weird, isn't it? Like, it's definitely...
It's a bit weird. It's also really unclear, to me anyway, what this power structure looks like, because it seems like it's being treated... They are being treated as if they are the new government, kind of.
So,
almost as if they've been as if it's a new administration. But from what I understand, each of the regional kind of like captains, like heads of the militia in each of the kind of like regions and cities that they've taken, have been saying sometimes very divergent things to media, especially when it comes to the rights of women and expectations around education and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's most people have greeted those kind of promises with a heavy degree of skepticism, I think it's fair to say. And I mean, I'm not hardly an expert on the region, but I just don't think... I mean, they're going to renege on a lot of things, aren't they? Like the rights of women are definitely going to be worse off as a result of the Taliban being in charge, even if they're not as bad as they were 20 years ago before the Allies came in.
I don't think the Taliban have necessarily been introduced to third wave feminism.
I guess it's something that sort of interested me in all of these debates, because I don't imagine there is good sort of polling on, I couldn't find any good polling on the actual attitudes of people living in Afghanistan as to, you know, whether, you know, women's rights and that sort of thing. But it wasn't clear to me that actually there was majority support among Afghan people for, you know, the right women's right to work, for instance, just to pick one thing. And I think that it's probably one of the dangers of, like, the, as you say, there are some very highly educated people in Afghanistan, and they do have an international footprint, and they do appear on, like, you know, the BBC and that kind of thing, and they say, they give a certain account of events from their perspective. But I do sort of wonder, because in my impression is that in Afghanistan generally, obviously, you know, people are much more socially conservative, and so the idea that you can actually impose liberal democracy from the top down, and that's, you know, maybe you can do it over a very long period of time, and I guess they'd argue that that was what was done during the denazification of Germany and that kind of thing. To some degree, I don't know. It's but I suppose what I'm asking is, was it ever really likely? Yes, there are some success stories where, you know, you have countries like South Korea, which went from being, you know, poor and backward economically to being a very like modern liberal democracy, and that happened relatively quickly in the scheme of things. But
places like Taiwan as well.
Yeah, so there are places where that those sort of things can happen, but it doesn't. They didn't. From my point of view, just reading around the subject, there didn't appear to be good signs that much of this was actually holding above like a certain level. And actually the fact the Taliban have won so comprehensively so quickly, you know, seems to indicate that a lot of the advances were relatively shallow, I think. That's my kind of view on things.
Maybe. I just think about the people, especially the women, who are going to have all of those expectations and hopes taken away from them. And that's kind of like one of the reasons where there has been a promise of providing refugee status for especially women, children. Sexual minorities have also kind of like come into the mix, but I'll be honest, I've researched a lot about the way that European countries tend to deal with LGBT refugees from especially the Middle East, and it isn't particularly good, so we'll see what happens there. It's kind of like opening a door and then having it slammed in those women's faces that I think is particularly the heart-wrenching thing. And maybe it is shallow, but it is at least profound for those people who have been touched by it.
Yeah, definitely.
To the point where they have, clung to the outside of aeroplanes as they took off. There was this horrible poetry of the similarities between the shots of the Twin Towers with people throwing themselves off the top of the buildings. And the little dots alongside the massive skyscrapers circled in newspapers. And a similar thing with American planes taking off from Afghanistan. And you see the dots underneath the aeroplanes as people fall off. Like, I mean, it's clearly enough for people to hang on to that hope. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think some of it, and this is one of the areas that the Allies have been rightly criticised over things, is that there's a lot of people who effectively had staked their lives on the Americans continuing to be there and at least continuing to support the regime that was set up, the government that was set up, and having backed the wrong horse, as it were. You know, the other horse is now in charge. I think I've sort of lost my way with the metaphor, but
sure.
Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of people whose lives are now at risk because they sided with the Americans and the American-backed government, and now the Taliban's are in. There's a lot of fears about revenge taking place, not just for them, but also not just for, say, you know, an interpreter who worked with the Americans, but also the interpreter's family and other people connected to them. So I think some of that desperation you see in people clinging to planes is not just about it's not just about feeling a strong sense of passion for the now fallen government. It's also about just survival, you know, just wanting to stay alive, basically.
Touching on the personal, I want to zoom back out. Why am I now in love with Theresa May? What is it about former kind of like wet fart prime ministers becoming backbenchers again and me just falling in love with them? It happened with Gordon Brown, happened with John Major. I love the death out of them. She had a really scathing speech when Parliament was recalled after it was clear that the Taliban were taking Kabul. And she basically asked, what is the point in the United Kingdom, in global Britain, invoked global Britain, if as soon as the US decide to pull out of Afghanistan, it's no longer viable for us to be there? Like, what is the point in something like NATO if it requires the US to be able to do absolutely everything? Now, people have extrapolated from that the necessity for there to be, what's the percentage for NATO? Is it 2% of national spending?
Yeah, I think it's 2%.
It's something like that, right? Yeah. To be in defense, and there's only three members of NATO that meet that percentage, and that's the US, France, and the UK. You seem.
Is it France? I thought it was a smaller country like Denmark or something like that. But I suppose it doesn't really matter. It's the fact is, it's there's not many countries that meet it. And the other thing is that, but this is an argument about, you know, wider military posturing, whether you go down a route whereby, as the UK, whether you go down the route of you have a bit of everything and you maintain a full spectrum of capabilities, or whether you specialise in certain things and then rely on your allies to specialise in different things and then work mm-hmm. together. But I think that I was listening to, I think it was Tom Tugendhat, who's the chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, and he said, I mean, he wasn't in favour of Britain pulling out, but he seemed to think that Britain would have struggled to maintain a useful presence there because we lack some capabilities that the US was providing, and that if we were going to stay there long term, we would have to we'd have to rely on allies basically to actually provide some of those other capabilities in various ways.
Treat it like a colony, essentially. Right? Do you not think that that's essentially what it would boil down to?
Not necessarily. I think there's a way of just providing military support and, you know, military assistance, among other things, and allowing the Afghan government to continue running things without it being like a full-blown colony. I mean, I suppose in some respects it would still seem like a colony because, you know, it's totally reliant on the sort of imperial state, if we're going with this metaphor, to actually prop itself up. So, but, you know, over the long term, if you did that and the governance structure, I mean, this is essentially what the people were saying who are advocating that we should have stayed, is that if the governance structures improve enough and attitudes change among the Afghan people, over time, you could turn it into a stable country. Maybe not like a, you know, a full-blown liberal democracy, but something that is better.
So were you Boris Johnson and you got the call from Bidey Widey and he said, sorry, mate, I'm tapping out. If you were Boris, what would you have done? You'd have gone, poff, 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 poff.
I don't know. I think in some ways it's harsh to criticise Boris Johnson in particular for this, because it is largely an American decision that has been made, and, you know, we would have had to, I think in practice it sounds as though we'd have had to have found other allies to help us maintain a presence there in a useful way. And I mean, I guess you can say that you know, following Brexit, Britain's international reputation is not the best, and that we mm-hmm. might
your fault
my fault, and we would have found that difficult to do as a result of that, among other things. I mean, also, I suppose that a lot of our European allies just don't buy into foreign occupations in the way we do. I mean, to be fair, like, France has had an ongoing mission in Mali, I think it is. And there were a lot of different countries that contributed to the Afghan operation because it was a NATO mission rather than just something the British and Americans had spearheaded, as was the case in Iraq. I don't know. I mean, there are good arguments for us to, you know, for a Western military presence to have stayed there, despite the lack of public popularity in that policy. But it would have required more than just Britain to do so, I think. And if we weren't able to arrange that kind of coalition in order to keep the mission there, then I don't know that we really had the option just to stay there by ourselves, because I don't know if we had the capabilities to do it. That seems to be what most analysts I've read or commentators I've read have said. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't entirely blame Boris Johnson. I mean, it was obviously a problem he inherited, and it's obviously a decision that has been made principally by the Americans. So I don't know. You actually mentioned, I think this was before we started recording, Dominic Raab's interesting week in relation to...
People keep on trying to find different reasons for him to resign, which kind of, like, I get, it's fun, isn't it? I'm not sure I've been particularly convinced by any of those arguments, though. How have you felt?
So just for the listeners who've not heard this, Dominic Raab was on holiday in Crete when...
A luxury holiday in Crete on a five-star villa.
Yeah, as it is. Yeah. So he was living at large in Crete on holiday when Kabul fell to the Taliban. And he didn't initially rush back home on the next plane. He hung around, I think, for a day or so.
Yeah. Well, he's like, I'm the foreign secretary and I'm going to foreign at the moment, so it's part of the job.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, different people take different views on this, I guess. Some people, I mean, obviously, ministers do need holidays in order to make good decisions, but whether you need to, that doesn't mean you need to, you know, you need to stay on holiday if a crisis erupts, as is the case this time around. Mm-hmm. So I think he should have come back more or less immediately and actually helped sort things out. But there is a wider argument that, you know, ministers
rest. Didn't have a conversation with the foreign... He didn't have a phone call with the foreign minister of the now...
defunct Afghan government. So there was stuff like that, and he obviously, his spinners have maintained that he was doing stuff behind the scenes and trying to support people.
Yeah, of course, by the pool.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, he probably should have come back in the same way that Boris Johnson should have come back off holiday when the London riots were happening in 2011. You know, generally, if some crisis erupts.
But yet again, Boris Johnson can't fire him because Boris Johnson is guilty of the same bad behaviour.
Yeah. I suppose that is one advantage of working for Boris Johnson.
It's a low bar to keep your job.
It is a low bar. Before we wrap up this segment, what do you think is going to happen to Afghanistan in the near future? Just a small topic to sink your teeth into.
Oh, yeah, just like a light question to end this. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, Afghanistan is famously... next to impossible to govern, isn't it? Because of its geography and kind of like cultural differences, it hasn't kind of been left alone for a while. And it will at least be... I don't think it's good for any of those people who are clinging to the underbellies of planes. And I don't think it's going to be particularly good for the people who aren't going to be able to get refugee status because of the limited numbers that countries like the UK, despite causing all of this shit, are going to... the places that they're going to give refugees from Afghanistan. But I'm interested to see what a Taliban-led Afghanistan may end up looking like. It's probably not going to be an ally, is it? But it is at least... you could market it as a grassroots movement, couldn't you? It's a bottom up rather than a top down.
I suppose I'm not sure I do see that, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I don't know. ISIS are still present in parts of Afghanistan and still like part of the caliphate is in Afghanistan. And it will be interesting, terrifying, if Afghanistan then becomes somewhere where ISIS can have more of a hold. The Taliban are bad, but ISIS are proper nut jobs. I think that's the main worry, isn't it? I don't know. I feel like that there's going to be an inevitable... new invasion, although maybe the power vacuum that exists is going to allow for there to be more of a presence, a non-military presence from places like China. And China, for all of its baggage, is actually quite good at creating stability in a region through economic means rather than military. At least surface level.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's quite happy to pour in investment into areas and also actually provide you know, Chinese workers to actually get projects off the ground and that kind of thing. So
yeah,
and,
exactly. Maybe a few roads will fix everything.
Well, people have made the point that Afghanistan, I think, is kind of adjacent to the whole Belt and Road initiative that the Chinese Communist Party is pushing, in terms of essentially that's just developing trade links with various places. So I think that now the West has left, I think the likes of the Russians and the Chinese will feel more able to maneuver in Afghanistan and
hey, maybe the Russians
influence.
Will invade again. That'll be fun. Replay the 1980s. Classic. It's retro now. Everybody's using synths and the Russians are invading Afghanistan. No, so not funny. shall we... you wrote a really great piece about the Plymouth shooting. Do you want to give us the 411? Like, what happened and what was your take? Jimmy Nichols, journalist and of Substack fame.
Of Substack fame. Well, as we were saying in the introduction, Jake Davison, you know, in an argument that started off in his house, he killed his mum with a shotgun and then went outside into Plymouth and just essentially just shot people he ran into, basically. And he killed five people. I think it's two adult men, two adult women, and one girl who was the daughter of one of the men. And then eventually when the police showed up, he turned the gun on himself and killed himself. And I think that when this story was kind of emerging on, it wasn't the Thursday just gone, it was the one previous to that, Thursday and Friday, immediately some people started flagging up his links to the incel community or communities. And that basically are various forums and, you know, message boards, and there's also YouTube channels and other things where people, essentially largely young men who are frustrated at their inability to get laid, congregate and, you know, to some degree show solidarity to one another, to some degree bitch about it, and to some degree, you know, encourage each other in quite unpleasant views about women in particular, but also society at large. And some people really tried to frame this as a terrorist attack. I'm not, obviously terrorist can be quite a difficult word to define, particularly when you're...
I believe it technically, legally, gets defined as needing, or like the goal is to change something political, or to have it based in it's to change something political.
It's
like the legal wording behind it. I mean you go on, but I remain to be, there is a cliche of kind of like the white gunman being explained as having like mental health issues rather than being called a terrorist. But I do see, I struggle to define this as a terrorist attack. I'm not sure. I think he was just a really sad guy.
Yeah, so...
Who had really bad mental health issues.
My view is basically the same. I think there's a phenomenon you can observe among left-wing commentators that whenever a white gunman commits an atrocity, they're always very eager to label it as a terrorist thing to actually bring some sense of parity to when, like, you know, traditionally a Muslim terrorist commits a similar act.
I think that's broadly the correction of something that has that's a correction of a phenomena that has happened in the past.
Yes.
Of people who are white supremacists, for example, not being labeled as such, like, I, for example, the Joe Cox murder was almost definitely, like, you can class that as a terrorist attack and an assassination.
I think he was prosecuted as a terrorist as well.
Exactly.
But that had a clear
that has historically happened
to
very
it.
Much
whereas in the case of Jake Davison's actions, it's not obvious at all. Excuse me. It's not obvious at all that he was politically motivated. I mean, part of the reason that it has been, you know, people have attempted to label it as political is because of his links to the incel community. And there have been famous cases. I think Elliot Rodger in the US was the famous one where he went out.
From 2014?
Something like that, yeah.
Not very long ago.
Went out and deliberately targeted women and to kill them. And
right, yeah.
But...
And I think that can be classed, like Elliot Rodgers, and is kind of like a I've read going ER is a thing when somebody from the incel community or certain incel communities is seen as kind of like going off the rails a little bit.
Yeah.
I think that is a lot easier to prescribe a terrorist attack because there was something specific about who he was targeting.
Yeah, whereas in this case...
Whereas I don't see that.
Yeah, here. It's not obvious here that he was... I mean, he killed his mum, and that was presumably targeted. He, you know, according to reporting, he didn't have a good relationship with his mum by the end of their lives. But if you look into the backstory of this guy, and this is essentially the point of my piece, was that I think he was just a very sorry character. He was clearly very, very frustrated, not just sexually, but with a lot of aspects of his life.
In some of his YouTube videos, he talked about some people are going to get support from their parents and be loved and cared and feel cared for by their parents, maybe be subbed on rent if they can't afford it 1 month or something along those lines. Mm. He felt like he'd gotten the... Also, Plymouth, he was, what, early 20s?
22, yeah.
I mean, lovely in the summer, but Plymouth is not the kind of place for a 22-year-old to maybe find them, to have the best time. no shade in the southwest, but there's only so much that you can do with your local spoons.
He was working as a crane operator for Babcock, mm-hmm. Which is mostly a military and defence contractor.
Mm-hmm. Which makes sense for a town like Plymouth.
Yeah, he was living at home with his mum, and he'd been diagnosed with autism when he was younger and seemed to be struggling with that. He had really, really terrible, as is true of a lot of incel men, he had very terrible body image problems. He seemed to think he was ugly. He spent a lot of time like lifting weights. There were quite a lot of, I mean, mm-hmm. his YouTube account's been closed down now, but my understanding
he used steroids, active on some steroid forums and stuff like that. Sorry, you were saying?
Well, I was just saying there's a lot of weightlifting videos on his YouTube channel before it was shut down. Mm. I've mostly read transcripts of what he said, but I saw a video on the Daily Mail's website that they'd clearly pinched before it was taken down, and he just seemed like a really unhappy guy that was just, you know, really frustrated about his life, and
which I think didn't really gel with the way that he was portrayed secondhand, like from secondhand sources a lot, like. What was the name of the academic who does the incel podcast?
Nama Coates.
Yeah. She kind of like in a piece that she did for Unheard, and you should all listen to the podcast that she did about it as well. Kind of like showed how, or used an example how a lot of media were using the fact that he referenced the Terminator. In one of his most recent videos as kind of like he's a soulless killing machine.
Yeah.
Whereas actually, apparently according to another creator on YouTube who managed to grab a lot of the content off of his YouTube channel before it was deleted, was like, he just liked the movie. a load of his liked videos on YouTube were kind of like character analysis of the Terminator and stuff, and he was talking about it as a way to motivate himself to be better, like a machine, like the Terminator.
Yeah, I mean, like the one video I saw did include a reference to Terminator, but it wasn't very much in the positive sense of, oh, you know, the Terminator faces all these extreme odds against him, but he keeps going. And it was a self-motivational affection for the character, I would say. It wasn't that he was aspiring to be a murderer, which, you know, is what he's ended up as. I mean, maybe there are some other videos that I haven't seen where, you know, he does talk more about sort of violence in that way, but I haven't seen that evidence.
We're approaching him with empathy and sadness, I think.
Mm.
He's a murderer, though.
He is a murderer,
Should we be doing this?
I mean,
there's a
practical argument that If you want to prevent or mitigate the risk of these kind of things happening again, it makes sense to understand where somebody's coming from. I think I effectively made the point by the end of my Substack that it's quite easy to imagine if he'd been given better support that he wouldn't have done this. You know, better, you know, mental health provision being the main one. If he'd had a social circle of friends, because that was one of his problems.
He was looking for someone to mentor him. Really, I got the vibe from some of the videos that I saw. He just needed someone to help him.
Yeah,
and there weren't no one to help him.
I mean,
and I think it's like I keep on thinking about like. They say that it is about 4 months to get on a non-urgent therapist's, to see a non-urgent therapist for the first time. And that's just for an assessment.
Yeah.
It is not, and urgency for a therapist is suicidal. And suicidal plans is the only way that you skip that queue. 4 months is a goal. And maybe it isn't the goal, it's said as kind of like the longest that you will wait, but that's for an assessment. The waiting list and the amount of time it takes for a normal person who can't afford 75 quid an hour to get in front of somebody who can give you a structure to be able to approach your mental health, especially as kind of like somebody who's who lives with autism as well, that's not good enough. And then, like, he's the extreme of the deficiencies in this, of kind of like our approach to mental health in this country. Mm. And it's very fashionable to talk about it nowadays. But unless you provide the infrastructure and actual timely and the money for people to be able to see and get help with their mental health as adults, it gets incredibly hard to get help support for stuff like learning disabilities and other stuff as an adult than it is as a child. There are so many people who are stuck and who are not going to contribute to society in the way that they could because of their mental health not being in front of somebody who can help them deal with their mental health problems.
Yeah.
And there's just going to be loads of people, like most of them aren't going to kill anybody, but there's loads of people who are just sad and getting on with it. Like him.
Yeah. I mean, until he did this, that is kind of what he was doing. I mean, there's been reports today that he was involved in some sort of violent incident, an assault, which is why his gun was taken away from him. Mm-hmm. And then it was eventually... He was put on a rehabilitation program, and then it was given back to him. So, I mean, I'm not trying to say this guy is like... I mean, obviously, this guy did an awful thing, is a murderer, and I would never argue that, you know, particularly the people affected shouldn't be angry about him and shouldn't hate him. That's not really what I'm saying. I'm just saying that there are aspects of his story that I thought, you know, were quite empathetic. As it were, like he was a loser who'd like lost in life, basically. That was certainly how he felt, and I think it's very apart from anything else, it's sad when somebody who's only 22 years old feels that way. Do you know what I mean? When they've to use a cliche, got their whole life ahead of them. I think it's kind of a tragedy that his life ended up the way it did, and I think you can say that. While also thinking what he did was awful, and that he was a bad person for doing that. You know, it doesn't have to be just one or the other, would be my argument. But I'm sure some people listening to this, or I'm sure if the you know, some the families of the victims heard this sort of argument, they would not be impressed by it. And I
understand why the BBC and the Guardian haven't necessarily taken this angle. Let's just say that.
Yeah, I can see that. But it's, you know, the newsletter is called The Contrarian, so. Yeah, provide what it says on the tin.
I remember the Contrarian YouTube channel, Jimmy.
Yeah, I think it's hidden away.
Those
now.
Were the days.
Yeah,
those were the days. Speaking of being contrarian, why is it actually? You said that you were never a user of and you weren't aware of the site OnlyFans before maybe a year ago when lockdown became a thing and it ballooned. Really, didn't it? Is that kind of like what caused it?
Yeah, so like it was founded in 2016, and it sounds like you were aware of it from earlier than I was. But I've only
it's big in the gay. We love porn actors.
Okay,
so they are the footballers of our world.
Okay,
them and drag queens, porn stars and drag queens are the people that we aspire to be.
So yeah, I wasn't aware of it, but it like
it's been a meme in the queer community for a very long time.
Right, I think it just became more prominent during lockdown. I think because people had more time to both make and consume the kind of content that OnlyFans was providing, and it over time there's just been more and more focus on it in the media, so more and more reporting about you know, the sort of stuff that goes on there, more questions about the morality of allowing people to, you know, sell sexy videos and pictures to people on a direct basis.
I just can't take you seriously when you say the word
sexy.
Sexy.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can pull it off. But I think there's a lot of like there's a lot of feminists who are very skeptical about OnlyFans as a model. I mean, they tend to be the sort of feminists who are skeptical about sex work in general. But even aside from the stuff around like there being, you know, underage content on the site, which is something you referenced earlier and does appear to have been a motivation for the payment processors to disengage with.
I will say, like, obviously any underage stuff on the site is really, really bad, but they did a transparency report and they found 15 accounts that had underage content, right, and removed them all. And I see I'll use Snap as kind of like the an equivalent of this. It was well known as being as kind of like, it was a lot of teenagers sending dick pics to one another because it vanished after 30 seconds. And they managed to go public. They managed to have an IPO. And I think it's the fact that it is explicitly sex work, surely. Like obviously there is a reason behind the likes of Visa and MasterCard not wanting to process the payments of this website. But I feel like it's the wider societal stigma towards supporting sex work as a whole. No?
I think there's an element of that. Like, there is a certain prudishness about sex work. But I mean, there's also a lot of genuine skepticism about whether sex work should be promoted as a legitimate career, basically, or a legitimate job, let's say.
Sure, it'll exist whether we want it to be or not.
That is true of most crime, though, isn't it? And that doesn't mean we don't try and deter crime. So I don't really see that as an argument, to be honest with you.
I don't have a moral panic around sex work, so obviously I'm not going to feel particularly worried about people doing sex work. I think that it is, when you make it a crime, it becomes a lot more damaging than it would be if it were in the light and regulated and clear, and had the support of the law rather than being a negative recipient of kind of like legal decisions. I think this is a weird parallel and maybe a flawed one, but in the similar way too, I think that abortions are going to happen regardless, and they're going to be more damaging if they are made illegal, because people will seek to do them anyway. And I feel the same way about drugs as well, actually. Like, society has decided that those three things, drugs, sex work, abortions, very often, especially sex work and abortions, tied to kind of like, I don't want to get too MA with this Jimmy, like a bit too analytical, but very often tied to women claiming power over their bodies.
I see.
That's, just saying.
Yeah.
I'd rather those things were in the light and regulated, and there were an open conversation that we had, rather than being buried in the dark.
Well, I don't want to get into whether sex work should be legal.
Don't you?
The thing is, all of the stuff that was most of the stuff that was going on to OnlyFans was legal content. Like, it is legal for people to film themselves masturbating and to sell that video to somebody else. That's like a, that's a legal activity. Mm-hmm. And OnlyFans really was just providing a convenient platform for people to sell or to buy that kind of material, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it is a little bit weird that the financial companies seemingly have taken it on themselves to actually pressure the websites, pressure the websites into stop hosting this sort of thing.
Well, we've covered the kind of like the encroaching rules and the tone being set by conservative governments. I think they were even proposed under Cameron around kind of like restrictions on what should be visible and how it should be visible and how it should be gatekeeped with pornography online.
Mm.
If you remember, kind of like, I think famously, sitting on somebody's face was going to be become an illegal sex act. And then a load of people on Parliament Square sat on each other's faces. It was quite brilliant. Like, one of my favourite protests ever. I see this... I think that there are wide... I think that the moral question around sex work is thoroughly uninteresting, to be completely honest, because I just think it's prudishness, and when it comes to things like that, I'm more of a... I've made clear what my stance is, and I think that you're an idiot if you don't think it, frankly.
So you personally don't find it interesting because you've made your mind up?
No.
That's what you're saying.
But what I think... Yeah, exactly. And if you haven't come to the same conclusion, then you is dumb.
On that point, it's not purely...
No, I should have just kept quiet.
It's not purely prudishness that the argument is about. Like, if you read a lot of, feminist writers who are opposed to sex work being legitimized, the arguments are all around the opportunities for women to be abused when those industries flourish, basically. The fact there's a lot of like anti-porn campaigners who will say that the ready availability of porn to young men has led to like women being abused in one-night stands and that sort of thing, being sort of slapped and spat on and so on. Non-consensually, I should add.
Mm-hmm.
So the arguments are all about harm. They're not about prudishness, I wouldn't say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you may disagree with those arguments, but I don't think you characterise them fairly.
I disagree with those arguments because I think it is more dangerous that that people choosing to do sex work becomes illegal. I don't think people should do sex work. I obviously don't think that people should do sex work out of need, because they don't have any other economic options, and I don't think they should do sex work, be forced to do sex work, obviously. But those people are in more danger, I think, as it is delegitimized, as opposed to when it is regulated.
Mm.
Them's my feelings. But obviously, I've just said that I don't find any of that interesting. What I do find really interesting is approaching this from kind of like a platform economy perspective, and oh dear, am I part of BreadTube now? I think I might be. And from a Marxist perspective of workers seizing the means of production. So I think that OnlyFans and other subscription services that have provided a place for sex workers to continue to do sex work in the pandemic, which was why there was kind of like this big boom, because a lot of people were alone and
with time on their hands
had time on their hands, maybe needed a little bit of stimulation, content creation sites that are around adult sex work provides is it bypasses all of the gatekeepers that have traditionally existed in different types of sex work, whether that's as a model in performance, so a porn actor or a porn model, and also from the hierarchical, often misogynistic ways that somebody you would crudely call a pimp controls and gatekeeps the types of people that then have access to the women that are seen as working for him, or the men that are working for him, or anybody that is working for him. And what stuff like OnlyFans allowed was a complete removal of, for example, like porn studio and a small number of porn studio and porn producers who were making pornography, and allowing those porn actors to directly access the people that wanted to access their content. And also the ability for them to bypass the toxic relationships with like a pimp or a John or anything along those lines. And actually, like, OnlyFans provided a much safer space for a lot of people who do sex work. And what this has done is that is has pulled the rug out from under their feet and has taken away that means of bypassing those gatekeepers and, like I said, seizing the means of production and having a say over what they were making. I believe OnlyFans took about 20% of transactions. There is going to be a fleeing to other sites, so
I was going to say, presumably, you know, people will move to existing sites, or somebody will say, well, clearly there's a huge market for this sort of thing. I'm just going to set up a new OnlyFans that is dedicated to porn.
So obviously, I'm in the queer space, and there is a porn actor called Austin Wolf. I wouldn't Google that, Jim, just for your own reference. Who owns his own kind of like version of OnlyFans called ForMy.Fans.
Right.
And they have been, I mean, frankly, making hay off of this decision from OnlyFans, but they saw it coming for a really long time. And that is more so than the OnlyFans model, which was set up by some lad in Essex.
It's always the Essex guys you have to watch out for, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Shut up, you. you filthy xenophobe. But this was made with adult sex work in mind, the For My Fans kind of like site.
Yeah.
And so it feels like a much safer space for people who are in that community. I don't know how they bypass the same payment problems that For My Fans, that OnlyFans had. I believe it is a much more bespoke system where not just anybody gets accepted onto the site. But I just see this kind of like continually being a problem, because it happened with places like Patreon, where adult content was rejected and you can no longer have adult content on there. Now OnlyFans, everyone's fleeing to other platforms. But as long as kind of like that financial part of the system continues to be prudish, overly cautious, or justifiably cautious, depending on what you think about it, this is going to continue to be a problem regardless of where these content creators and their viewers go.
Yeah, and I think it's unlikely that a government is going to intervene to force the financial companies to provide financial services to these sorts of platforms. It just seems like an unlikely thing for them to do.
A particularly liberal European state might.
Possibly. Yeah, I guess we could see that. But I imagine, I mean, it's been a while since I've written about payments, but I imagine you need payment processing facilities in, you know, every jurisdiction you operate in. So I don't know how helpful that is, I guess.
And there's only so many countries or so many companies that provide that infrastructure.
Yeah. So I mean, finance,
like Visa and MasterCard.
Finance is quite monopolized, is a bit too strong, but it's always made up of a handful of big companies.
It's like going basically to the supermarket.
Yes, it is. So you see,
and some supermarkets also have finances. Anyway, so go on.
You seem you're more bummed out about this story than I thought you'd be, actually. Is that fair? You seem genuinely done in and by it.
I think it's really bad. I think it's going to be really bad for those who have been liberated by through the choice of doing sex work digitally, which has allowed them to practice sex work in a much safer way. And to have control over who they have sex with and when and how often and what kind of content they make and all of those kinds of things. I see it really similarly to the YouTube community. And the reason that I approach it from kind of like that economic liberation perspective is because it's similar to a load of the stuff that I have written in the past around YouTubers and their seizing of the means of production, which gradually, as like always happens whenever a platform grows, those liberties tend to restrict broadly.
Yeah, I mean, as internet companies get older, they tend to establish more control.
Unless apparently your Twitter, I feel like all of porn is on Twitter at the moment.
So I was reading somewhere that Twitter's actually the only social network that still allow, or the only mainstream social network that allows pornography to be posted on it. And obviously Twitter does have a bit of a back history of being a free speech platform, so perhaps it's slightly ideological with them that they're still willing to do that. But you know, I mean,
I'd be curious to see how much of its traffic is, how much of its content is pornography. I want to see that.
Maybe you should write to Jack Dorsey, ask him for the data. I'm sure
send
I'll hand
him
it
an
over.
Email. He's probably jack@twitter.com, isn't he?
Probably, yeah. Hand it over, Jack. We need to see these numbers.
Mm.
All right, so have we said everything we want to say about OnlyFans, Afghanistan, and Plymouth?
You're tired.
I'm a little bit tired. But yeah.
Just so you know, as I was going on that kind of like really interesting, actually, I think, rant, where I was breaking down kind of like how this community is being affected by these decisions. Jimmy was yawning all the way through.
I had a more exciting night last night than I'd intended to. So
I watched three Evangelion movies back to back, so I had a great night.
Sounds appealing now in my slightly hungover state. So Jazza, where can they find you on the internet? Not OnlyFans, I don't think.
Jazza John. I mean, if I had an OnlyFans. Jazza John on all social media, because Jimmy, what am I?
You're a good internet boy.
Thank you. And where can they find you?
You can only find me on Twitter, where I, you know, is the only one I frequent, because you can post pornography, obviously.
And subscribe to his Substack, because occasionally it's good.
Occasionally. It's great every week, mate. It's just you don't read it every week.
Okay. I'll take your word for it, because I don't read every week.
Fair enough.
Sometimes I have a lot of marketing emails to unsubscribe from, you know?
Yeah, that's fair enough. And, you know, back in the day when you were posting YouTube videos, I would only watch them occasionally. So I suppose it's fair, isn't it? Tit for tat.
Yeah. okay, bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.